Take our Bible now and turn to Matthew chapter 5. If you notice on the bulletin, this is part 4 in our ongoing study of what Jesus meant when he said that we are the salt of the earth. Probably never heard a 2-3-4-part series on this verse. And just so you know, there is one more after this. We will wrap it up, Lord willing, next Sunday. But we've been taking our time going through it because this is so important. If this is who we are, and as we've been discussing, this is our job, this is our function in the world, we better get it right. We better know what it means, and then what it, in terms of what it means, know how to live what it means. And so we've had an outline helping us to get through this. 4 points, the presupposition, the purposes, the pitfalls, and the plan. We spent the first week, I think, with just the presupposition. And the presupposition, just to remind everybody, if you haven't been with us, it comes at that last part of the first phrase in verse 13, you are the salt of the earth. The presupposition is the earth. And just like where in verse 14 he says, you are the light of the world, the presupposition is the world. In other words, we have a function, we have a job description in the world, in the earth, and the presupposition is that that job description is based upon what the earth is and what the world is. And spiritually, obviously, we're taking this, is that the earth is decaying. The earth, the world is corrupt. It's full of sin, full of lawlessness. We know that. these days, you don't need a Bible verse for that. Just turn on your TV or just walk down the street. So that's the presupposition. Whatever salt means and whatever light means, it's going to be in that context. And so the presupposition, that's pretty clear. And then the next point was the purposes. The purposes. And the reason why it's plural is because if we want to get the metaphor right, obviously salt, we're not literal salt, or we're not literal light. We are metaphorically salt, metaphorically light. We better understand what salt meant in ancient times. I mean, Jesus obviously had something in mind when he used the word salt. So in the first century, what was salt used for? And that was a bit of a Bible study. And I enjoyed that. I hope you enjoyed that. And that was just walking through, you know, I think there's some 50 uses of salt in the ancient world. We kind of reduced it down to a potential 11 and then worked through, I think, 5 just to condense it down. The closest analogy is the closest link that Jesus was using to salt as he related it to the disciples and to us. Some of the top ones, of course, is, well, if the world is corrupt, it needs a preservative. I think that's probably the most common usage of salt in the ancient times, but certainly in the commentaries and how they try to explain what salt is. And as we've said, I'm not sure that a decaying world needs preserving. I don't believe that we are called just to be a bit more moral than the immoral, as if that is going to solve anything at the end of the day. It's just going to be a Band-Aid of anything. It's just going to be maybe make life a little bit better, but we all know that we're going to die one day, and so the issue is an eternal issue when he says we are the salt and we are the light. Some say that it's just, you know, as you would salt your meal in terms of a seasoning, that's what we are. We go out in society and we give zest to society. Possibly. I don't think that's what Jesus meant. And so we worked our way through all those different options and we came to the conclusion, and then last time, if you were here, we worked through the Old Testament text that backed up and kind of proved our decision, and that was that salt meant purity. Salt had a purifying effect. It was an agent of purifying, whether it was purifying the baby when he was born, purifying the offering. All said and done, salt symbolizes purity. That's the purpose. Salt symbolizes purity, purity in life, purity in our relationship with God. And so when we read, you are the salt of the earth, well, that's what he meant. He meant that we are to, listen carefully, we are to be pure and we are to be the agents of purity. In other words, what do a lost, corrupt, decaying, wicked world need? Do they need seasoning? Do they need a bit more morality? Do they need some preserving? No, they need transformation. They actually need purifying themselves. And so we, with the gospel, are the agents of purity. After all, when it's all said and done, you notice at the end of verse 14, in the same way, let your light shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to your Father who is in heaven. That's the conclusion, if you will, of verse 13 to verse 14, or 16 rather, verse 16, is that we want to see them glorify God in heaven as we glorify God in heaven. Well, how's that going to happen? How does a sinner glorify God in heaven when he needs to get saved? And so just preserving him is not going to get them there. Just seasoning them is not going to get them there. No, transformation is going to have to get them there. And so that's why I said we come back to what is the salt. The salt and the light equal purity. So when Jesus says you and you alone, remember that's it's emphatic. You and you alone, that's it. You're the guys that I'm working with here. You and you alone are the salt of the world. He was basically saying, you, my disciples, you are like, and remember said this from last week, you are like the salt in the offerings. You will have a purifying effect in the world. The salt purified the offerings. You will have a purifying effect upon the world. Hopefully that was clear. You are my agents of purification. You are my agents of transformation. Again, just so we're absolutely clear, let me say it again. What the world needs most is what? Purifying. What the world needs most is cleansing. What the world needs most in transformation. And so how does that happen? I mean, who does that? Well, ultimately, God does that, right? God's the one that purifies. God's the one that transforms. God is the one that saves and regenerates. But how does he do that? Well, he does it through certainly the gospel, certainly through the Holy Spirit, but he does it in the human perspective through us. We are his ambassadors. We are his agents. We are the agents of purification, agents of transformation, if you want to put it like that. So all of that to say is we're not here to stimulate thirst. We're not here to flavor life. We're not here to preserve the decay and corruption. No, we're here to purify and transform. So that was the purposes. We want to move now to the pitfalls. So what's the pitfalls? Well, a good text to transition from purposes to pitfalls is Mark 9, and I want you to turn back to that text that Patea read. I think this will be helpful. One, to again, clarify what salt means when Jesus says you are the salt, but also, as I said, help us understand what the pitfalls are as well. Mark chapter 9, and Patea read it earlier, and I know it's a familiar text, but it's also very, I guess you can say, an alarming text. I say alarming text because it's Jesus speaking to his disciples and he's speaking some very alarming words. You say, like what? Verse 43. If your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Verse 45. If your foot causes you to sin, cut it off. Verse 47. If your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out. These are some of the most frightful words. And there's a lot of frightful words Jesus said, and these are some of them. What's Jesus' point here? Well, obviously he's not literal. He's not saying literally cut out your eye and literally cut off your foot and literally cut off your hand. But he is calling for something radical, nevertheless. He's calling for, lack of a better way of putting it, a radical discipleship. Radical discipleship. And you can say he's threatening. You say, is he threatening his disciples here? Yeah, I think he's threatening his disciples here. This is serious. He's basically saying, if you don't cut it off, or if you don't pluck it out, that is which causes you to live consistently in a life of sin. If your hand consistently causes you to sin, or if your eye consistently causes you to sin, or if your foot consistently causes you to sin, then you're in trouble. Because what does he say at the end there? If you continue in that, I'm going to cast you where? Literally throw. I'm going to throw you in hell. Now you say, can Christians lose their salvation? No, obviously not. We're not going to take that verse and then reorganize our whole theology just based on one verse. That's what we call reductionist theology. So what does Jesus mean here? He's not saying that if you don't deal with your sin, that Christians, real Christians, are going to lose their salvation. No, he's saying that if you don't deal with your sin, it might be that you're not a Christian to begin with. That's what he's saying here. In other words, what proves someone to be a real and true Christian? Let's take a step back. What really is the test? At the end of the day, whether you are a real and true Christian. Well, there's a lot of tests, but one is my life changed? Is my life changed to a point where I pursue holiness? Is my life changed to a point where I love holiness and I love purity and I want to pursue purity? Again, as a pattern. As a pattern. Remember, we always say it's not the perfection, but the what? It's the direction. We all sin. We all stumble. It's not that we're sinless, but we just desire to what? Sin less. That's a mark of a Christian. Psalm 97:10, all you who love the Lord hate evil. Mark it. You're a true Christian. You will hate evil. You will hate wickedness. You will want to be obedient to God. So, true disciples of Jesus Christ, you could say, because he's talking about discipleship here. True disciples of Jesus Christ strive against sin. They hate sin. They love purity. And so, if you claim to be a disciple of Jesus Christ and you don't strive against sin and your life is nothing but a pattern of doing sinful things, a pattern of going to sinful places and a pattern of thinking sinful thoughts, and of course that covers the hand, the foot, and the eye, doesn't it? Doing, going, thinking. If your life is nothing but a pattern of sinning, not the perfection but the direction, then, listen carefully, what you are proving is that you are not a true disciple. And Jesus here says, you, and he says it three times, you will be cast into hell, into the fire that shall never be quenched. You see it there at the end of verse 43, the end of verse 45, and verse 47. Make no mistakes. Jesus is serious here. He is deadly and eternally serious. Jesus is serious about those who claim to be his disciples. If you say, I'm a disciple of Jesus Christ, by saying you're a disciple of Jesus Christ, you are saying that Jesus is King and Jesus is Lord, and you better obey him. Otherwise, not only will you get these words out of his mouth to you, but he'll say, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and what? Not do the things I tell you. I mean, apart from these, what... Matthew 7 are probably equally frightful on that day. What day? The judgment day. Oh, Lord, Lord. Well, who are you? I never knew you. Why? Because you never did the will of my Father. What's the will of my Father? In a word, obedience. Same issue going on here. All right? Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter the kingdom of heaven, but he, and he alone, who does the will of my Father in heaven. So the issue that Jesus is raising here is obedience. On a corollary thought, he's talking about cutting off and plucking out. That's mortification, right? When we talk about putting to death the deeds of the flesh, he's talking about mortification, mortifying the sin in your life, being radical about it. Allegiance, loyalty, obedience, whatever word you want to use. Dealing with the sin in your life is the issue here. Holiness is the issue. And circling it back to what we're talking about, it's the issue is purity as well. Does that make sense? Purity of life is the issue. And again, don't make the mistake here of who he's talking to. He's speaking to his disciples. I mean, the whole discussion here is to his disciples. Now, on the heels of all that, verses 49 and 50, watch this. I love this. Verse 49, this is the same discussion. For everyone will be seasoned with fire. Literally, in the Greek, and you might have a translation that pulls this out, everyone will be salted with fire. Do you see that in your Bible? Everyone will be salted with fire. Now, if you have the New King James, or you might have something a little bit after that. And if you don't, there will be a footnote at the bottom, depending on the manuscripts, where it'll say, for everyone will be seasoned with fire, and every sacrifice will be seasoned with salt. Some of you see that? Now, that's an addition in terms of this manuscript family, and I'm guessing because of our study last week in Leviticus 2, where you season the offerings with salt, that the scribe here threw this in because it sounds like Leviticus 2. I don't have time to argue all that, but I think that's behind these words here. Everyone will be salted with fire. And then verse 50, notice this. Salt is good, but if the salt loses its flavor, how will you season it? Have salt in yourselves and have peace with one another. I mean, where does this come from? He's just talking about plucking and cutting off and pulling out, and then all of a sudden he's talking about salt. But it's in the same conversation. I mean, there's textual issues here on one hand, but there's also interpretive issues as well. I mean, what is he talking about here? Well, let's do our Bible study here. Let's make sure we get the flow. Jesus is speaking to his disciples, right? And everything he says up to this point, he's referring to the second person. Notice it's if your hand, if your foot, if your eye. And then there's a switch in verse 49 to what? Everyone. You see that? If everyone or everybody, depending on, again, what translation you have. But then when you get to verse 50, notice he reverts back to the second person. You, yourselves. So what's going on in verse 49? This is the question. And as I said, this will transition us into the so-called pitfalls. Now, if you're happy with the conclusion we've made that salt represents purity and purifying based on all those Old Testament texts, then verse 49, I'm going to be a bit paraphrastic here with the translation just so the meaning comes out. We could translate it like this. For everyone will be purified with fire. Everybody see that? Again, salt had a healing aspect. Salt had a purifying aspect. And here, Jesus is saying, if we bring that into the text, everyone will be purified with fire. Now, follow-up question to that is, purified in what sense? What do you mean, being purified with fire? Obviously, it's not saying that we're purified in the sense of being totally pure. Salt doesn't do that. It doesn't mean that we're purified in the sense of being saved. Salt doesn't save us. And of course, not everyone, and remember, he's talking about everyone here. Not everyone will be saved. Not everyone will be made pure in the sense that Jesus is pure. I mean, Jesus is not a universalist. We're not universalists. The key to understanding the salt here is actually understanding the fire. Because it says here, we will be salted with what? Fire. Or, again, if salt is equivalent to purity, then we will be purified with fire. In other words, what Jesus is getting at is that everyone, now listen carefully, everyone's true colors, that is, their true nature. I mean, whatever you show you're putting on the outside, all the external acts, all the vocabulary you've learned, whatever it is that's on the outside, your true nature, your true colors, that is, the real you on the inside, will one day be revealed, and it will be revealed in what? Fire. Everybody catch that? Now, does a Bible verse come to mind when you think of that? 1 Corinthians 3:13, doesn't it? Paul says there's going to come a time of testing, for the day will declare it because it will be revealed by fire. And the fire will test everyone's work of what sort it is. Everybody got that? Everyone will be purified in the fire. Everyone will be revealed in the fire. Jesus is pointing to a time when everything and everyone will be revealed. So again, just understanding what Jesus is saying here. Jesus' warning is that you say you're my disciple. You say you're my disciple. Then you better strive against sin. You better mortify the flesh. You can only fool people for so long, right? Time and truth will go hand in hand. The longer it goes, the truth will come out. And this is what Jesus is saying. One day you and everyone will be revealed. Everyone one day will be purified in the fire. The real you is coming out. And look, think of what we've been doing in the book of Hebrews with the warnings. The warnings sound pretty harsh. Well, that's why they're warnings, right? The writer of Hebrews sees these people that are drifting in dangers of apostasy. He has a duty to warn them that if they do apostate, they're going to be eternally lost. But that doesn't mean we change our understanding of salvation. It just means that the way to make sure that true Christians stay on the straight and narrow is how? Warn them. Because the Spirit of God takes that warning and does what? Pulls you up. I have been drifting. I have been backsliding. I have been playing too much with sin. I haven't been mortifying the flesh. And so the Spirit of God takes that warning and pulls them back. That's exactly what Jesus is doing here. If you're going to be my true disciple, you better get your act together. Because everyone one day will be revealed by fire. Everyone one day will be salted, purified with fire so that the true nature comes out. Does that make sense? In other words, deal with your life right now. Deal with the sin in your life. Now is the time to take radical measures in your life so as not to disqualify yourselves. This is serious. Now, again, that's verses, what, 43 to 49. And then again comes Jesus with one last exhortation. And look at verse 50. He says, salt is good. Good is kalos in the Greek. It's beautiful. It's attractive. But probably the best usage of the word is it's useful. It, you know, salt, it's nice to look at. And it's white. And that's nice. But we got to do something with it. So useful. Salt is good. Salt is useful. But notice what he says then. But if the salt becomes what? Unsalty. In other words, if it goes from pure to impure, what? How can it be pure again? What does he mean by that? What does he mean by that? How does salt go from pure to impure? How does it go from salty to unsalty? Well, by the way, notice where this whole discussion begins. That's why I had Potato start at verse 30 and read all the way down here, because you start with verse 30, but the main discussion here begins at verse 33. You see that? Because this whole discussion is, what's radical discipleship? Here they are. Notice what Jesus asks them. What was it you disputed amongst yourselves on the road to Capernaum? I mean, I heard some arguing in the back. What are you guys arguing about? They didn't want to tell him. Verse 34, they kept silent. Now, why were they silent? Because they were arguing about who would be the what. It's all about them. Who's going to be the greatest? Who's going to be the greatest? Well, here's Jesus taking a phenomenal opportunity to sit him down and talk to them about what true discipleship is. Right? What it really means to be great. And Jesus basically says, and I'm paraphrasing at this point just for the sake of time, have salt. You want to be great? You want to be one of my disciples? You better have salt in your life. That's the gist here. And you say, would they have understood that? Absolutely. Because what's the interpretation? Live a pure and holy life. If you want to be great, you want to be a disciple of mine, you better live a pure and holy life. And then notice in verse 15, what's the last part of that? What's the fruit of living a pure and holy life? Have peace with one another. Isn't that good? If you want to have peace with one another, then have salt. Have salt. Parallel to what we said this morning, you show me a church where there is no peace, but nothing but constant complaining and criticizing, I'll show you a church that's what? Unsalty. For that matter, a family. Show me a family who claims to be Christian, but inside there's nothing but constant arguing and bickering, I'll show you a family that's what? Unsalty. Or perhaps never had salt to begin with. But here's the question. How can it be salty again? Right? That's what he asks. How can it be salty again? Or that's the implication that he's asking here. Because it's the same question Jesus asked in the Sermon on the Mount. Now, with all that, go back to Matthew chapter 5. Again, we're transitioning from purposes to pitfalls, because hopefully now we're getting a little bit of a window on what the pitfall is. And Jesus says here in Matthew 5, verse 13, you and you alone are the salt of the earth. What's he saying? He's saying, you guys are, this is your job, this is your function. You are to live a life of purity and holiness in the earth. You are to live a life of purity and holiness in the world, because that's what a light is as well, right? We're not preserving the world. We're not preserving the earth. We're not preserving or seasoning, rather, the world or seasoning the earth. The issue is purity. Purity. We as Christians are to be salt. We are to have salt in ourselves. We are to be agents of salt in the world. And that is, as I said, we are to live pure and transforming lives. And in doing so, being the instruments of God in bringing purity and transformation to the rest of the world. Again, we could stop there. I think, at least in my mind, that's clear. That's crystal clear. And that would make sense, by the way, if you know, you come back to Matthew chapter 5. He begins the sermon with the Beatitudes, right? In other words, he begins with you personally. He begins with you in the sense that, hey, this is your character. Your character begins with all these Beatitudes. You have to have these Beatitude attitudes. And once you have these Beatitude attitudes, is once you begin with the individual and the character, then we transition into what? The conduct. And that's what the salt and the light are. Paul says the same thing, by the way. You remember his words to Timothy. He says, take heed to yourself and to your doctrine. Continue them, for in doing this you will save both yourself and those who hear you. That's another way of saying, Timothy, make sure your life is pure. Timothy, make sure your doctrine is pure. Why does he need to exhort Timothy, and all of us for that matter? Because our salvation, Timothy, your salvation, is dependent on that and everyone who hears you. In other words, your purpose is to be salt, is to be pure, to be wholehearted, to be loyal, to be faithful to the Lord. But here's the thing, and Jesus alluded to it in Mark 9, and he's going to allude to it here as well. With the purpose, with that purpose of being pure and the agents of purity, there comes the danger of being disqualified from that purpose. You can go from salty to unsalty. And that's where we want to talk now about the pitfalls. Notice again in verse 13. He says, you and you alone are the salt of the earth. But he doesn't stop there, does he? And here comes the pitfall. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. What's he saying here? Well, we know he's saying, I've given you a purpose in the world. We know he's saying, yes, I've given you a function in the world. But he's also saying, beware of the pitfalls. Beware of the pitfalls of being disqualified from that very function. In other words, listen carefully. Beware of losing your saltiness. You got that? Beware of losing your saltiness. Here's a warning. He's warning us. We as the followers of Jesus Christ can, listen, we can lose our ability to be agents of purity and transformation. We're not talking about losing our salvation. But we can lose our usefulness as the agents of purity and transformation. You say, how's that? How does that happen? Well, in a word, when our lives are not what? Pure. You got that? It happens. When we don't have salt in ourselves, when we allow the leaven, remember in the Levitical sacrifice? Don't put leaven in the sacrifice or the offering. Don't put honey. The leaven is the secularism or the legalism for that matter. The honey represents the worldly pleasures. But what you do put in is salt. You don't put in the leaven, you don't put in the honey, but you do put in the salt. Remember that from Leviticus 2? How do we lose our saltiness? How do we go from salty to unsalty? How do we go from pure to impure? When we mix it. When we mix the salt. When we put something in the salt that shouldn't be in the salt, it loses its purity. By the way, what's really interesting is most modern translations really miss the impact of what Jesus is saying here. You perhaps have salt losing its taste or salt losing its flavor, something like that. The Greek verb here is moroni. Moroni. What do you hear in that word? Moron. Moron, right? And that's exactly what Jesus is saying here. He's saying, you and you alone are the salt of the earth, but if the salt becomes foolish, that's the translation. That's literally how he puts it. You and you alone are the salt of the earth, but if the salt becomes foolish, and there is the pitfall, right? The pitfall is that you play the fool. Or literally, you become a moron. That word, by the way, moroni, is a word that emphasizes the mind. It literally means to lose the mind, right? To be mentally incapacitated. You can't think anymore. We've got a lot of those running around today, don't we? A lot of morons out there. They just can't think clearly anymore. And Jesus says here, you alone are the salt of the earth, but if the salt becomes moronic, the salt becomes foolish. That's why I find it very interesting, by the time you get to the intertestamental period, and even during the New Testament period for that matter, salt becomes a synonym for purity, but also becomes a synonym for wisdom. Metaphorically speaking, it would be purity and wisdom. In fact, one source said that the rabbis used to instruct their disciples to be modest, of humble spirit, industrious, and literally salted. Isn't that interesting? Can you imagine fathers pulling their sons aside, sitting them down and says, now son, I want you to be wise, bright, prudent, and salted. But they would have understood that. It was synonymous with being pure and to be wise. And I get that. That makes sense to me, because the fear of God, the beginning of the fear of God is what? Wisdom, right? The fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. The fear of God is obedience. You fear God, you keep his commandments. Obedience is the sign of wisdom, and it's also the sign of what? Purity, as we said. Purity is the outcome, actually, you could say, of both the wisdom and obedience. They're all connected. So you put salt together with purity, with obedience, and wisdom. They're all synonymous. They all are a family of words that go together, that are characteristic of the Christian. You say, well, the opposite is actually true as well. You put foolishness along with disobedience, with impurity, and unsalted. They would all be synonymous as well. So this is what Jesus is getting at. When he says you are the salt of the earth, he's saying, I need you to remain salty. And if you want to maintain your saltiness, you need to be two things. You need to be wise and you need to be prudent. Don't be foolish. Don't be foolish. Don't play the fool. Don't lose your saltiness. Now, think about this. And I'm not into props, so I didn't bring it. But let's say we have a little cup of salt up here. Salt is salt, right? Everybody knows what salt is. Salt is salt. You know, you put salt on the food, or even if you dip your finger into the salt and you taste it, it's salty. Salt that's pure it's going to taste like salt. When does it lose its saltiness? When does it lose its effectiveness? When does it lose its usefulness? How do you make salt go from salty to unsalty? What do you do? It's when you mix something with it, right? Do you ever put salt on the table, threw some dirt in it, mix it around, and then threw it on your meat? Who does that, right? That would be what? That'd be foolish. That would be stupid. That would be silly. But this is the point that Jesus is getting at. If salt stands for purity, and we are the salt of the earth, that is to say we are to be pure, we can't have our purity mixed with either the leaven of the world or the honey of the world or with the world, period. Does that make sense? The effectiveness, the usefulness of our job and function in the world depends on our saltiness. And what is saltiness? Our purity. Listen, if we lose our saltiness, if we lose our saltiness, there's only one reason for that. It's because we have mixed too much with the dirt of the world. Everybody got that? What did James say? Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this. Ready? To visit orphans and widows in their trouble and to keep oneself unstained from the world. That's what pure and undefiled religion is, being unstained from the world. Now, all of that to say is we've got to talk about the pitfalls, because the pitfalls are what? They're real. They're real. That's why Jesus has to address the pitfalls, because it's real. There's a propensity for believers to be unsalty. There's a propensity for believers. We're prone to wander, prone to leave the Lord our God we love, and to mix with the world. We become adulterated and mixed by this evil and corrupt world. And when that happens, we become disqualified for service. We become ineffective. We become worthless and useless. And dare I say, that's where the church is today. If you hadn't, were there on last Thursday with Shepherd's Conference, that was John's message basically on 1 Corinthians 6. That the church has mixed with the world. And when that happens, we lose our saltiness. And losing our saltiness, we have lost our usefulness. Warren Wiersbe, by the way, in his preface to a book, Be Holy, which is an exposition of Leviticus, writes this. He says, whatever else the professing Christian church may be known for today, great crowds, expensive buildings, big budgets, political clout, it's not distinguished for its holiness. Bible-believing evangelical Christians make up a sizable minority, but our presence isn't making much of an impact on society. The salt seems to have lost its saltiness, and the light is so well hidden from the marketplace, it's quite dark. End quote. Phil Newton, a Reformed Baptist pastor, illustrates this by noting, quote, two men, one a theologian and another pastor that was arrested in two different parts of the country for perverted immoral behavior. That is extreme, I grant you, yet it is not something that we can take lightly or think we are immune to in our own lives. Our propensity for sin is great, so we must constantly be anchored in the cross of Christ and his gospel. They have lost their saltiness in the world. But many more do that without ever being arrested for a crime. Complaining Christians are tasteless Christians. Those that are lazy, undisciplined, arrogant, prideful, critical, mean-spirited have lost their pungent influence upon the world about them. And then he asks, how about your pungency? Are you salty where God has put you? Or have you so given into the world that you are in danger of becoming tasteless to a world that desperately needs your saltiness in Christ? End quote. Well, we don't want to be foolish. We don't want to be useless. We don't want to lose our saltiness. But then Jesus asks a question here, just picking back up. He says, how shall it be made salty again? You see that? how shall it be made salty again? That is to say, what happens if Jesus' disciples become foolish and worldly? It happens. It happens all the time. What happens if Christians become morally and spiritually impure? What good are they? Jesus says, well, and he says it rather matter-of-factly, he says what? They are good for nothing. They are good for nothing. Literally, they're able to do nothing. They're useless, powerless. Came across this quote by a rabbi in 90 AD. He says, or he asks the question, if the salt starts to stink, with what shall one salt it? Let me say that again. If the salt starts to stink, with what shall one salt it? He replies, with the afterbirth of a mule. Now, why does he say that? Well, his point is, it's rhetorical. It can never be salted again. Why? Because mules never have what? Afterbirths. Everybody knows what a mule is, right? It's a hybrid. It's a hybrid between a horse and a donkey. They're incapable of reproduction. And his point is, salt, once mixed and impure, can never become salty again. It's impossible. I mean, think about it. If you have a cup of salt here and you threw some dirt in there and it's all mixed, good luck trying to throw it on and taking the dirt out from the salt. You're going to be there forever. It's done. Salt, once mixed and impure, can never become salty again. It is impossible. Impossible. So what's the answer to Jesus' question here? The answer is what? You can't. Can never be made salty again. Now, maybe we could say, well, with all things God are possible. And that would be the footnote to this. But Jesus here is making a point, and he needs to make a point without the footnote. This is serious. This is not to be taken lightly. Jesus seems to be teaching that when those who claim to be his disciples fail to be pure, their potential for changing the world is permanently damaged and cannot be restored. You say it another way. Although divine forgiveness removes all the eternal consequences of sin, it does not eliminate the temporal consequences of sin. You got that? The hypocrisy of those who do not practice what they preach does lasting harm to one's Christian's witness. We all know that. As one writer put it, Jesus taught that professing disciples whose lives are characterized by impurity will not only have ineffective ministries, but also they will have counterproductive ministries. End quote. And you can see that. Look at the end of verse 13. Jesus finishes this discussion on salt by saying, it is to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. What does he mean by that? Well, in short, what he means is that salt that is too corrupt to have a purifying influence, ultimately at the end of the day will have a destructive influence. That's what he's saying. Salt has lost its purity. In fact, it has a destructive effect. Rather than purifying the lives of others, it destroys the potential for life. Listen, when professing disciples lead impure lives, they invite what? Think about it. What did Nathan say to David? You have given an opportunity for the enemies of God to what? To what? Yeah, to mock. Expect spite. Expect contempt, even from a corrupt world. Now, notice Jesus doesn't say that men merely walk over the thrown out salt. What does he say? They trample on it. They trample on it. It's the same verb, by the way, over in chapter 7, verse 6, where he's describing the pigs trampling pearls with their hooves. What's his point here? The point is that the world that we are to purify, right? We're agents of purity. We're the salt of the world. That the world that we are to purify will, by our impurity, treat us with scorn and disgust. Now, we know, back up in verse 10, that we are going to be persecuted. But there we're persecuted for righteousness' sake. But when they trample on us because of our unsaltiness, they're trampling on us and persecuting for our what? Unrighteousness' sake. Now, we're going to get persecuted one way or another, but I think all of us would rather get persecuted for righteousness' sake than unrighteousness' sake, right? So how important is it to be aware of our pitfalls or losing our saltiness? Let me ask that again. How important is it to be aware of the pitfalls of losing our saltiness? Well, that's why we've taken our time to go from a presupposition to the purposes. Because we've got to get this right. If this is our job, our function, what we're supposed to be in the world, then we better get it right. And if you understand the evil and corrupt world we live in and our function and purposes in that world, then, in the words of the Apostle Paul to Timothy, you'll what? You will take heed lest you lose that function and purpose. I mean, you think about it, all the take heeds, all the bewares that Jesus gives. Do we actually do them? Do we do take heed? Do we do beware, as it were? You say, well, how do we do that? How do we take heed? How do we make sure that we're remaining our saltiness and we're not losing our saltiness? How can we become more effective and useful in the world as salt? Well, that's the plan, right? That's the plan. You say, what is the plan? Well, come back next week and we'll talk about that. We've moved from the presupposition to the purposes to the pitfalls, and now we've got to wrap this up with the plan. What is the plan so that we maintain our saltiness, that we don't lose our saltiness, and we become effective and useful in the world as salt?